with the nails still through their feet. They were all listening to Stebbins now. A horrified silence had fallen like a rubber sheet. The crowd was yelling at them, almost as if they could still hear. Some were yelling one guy's name, and some were yelling the other guy's. But the only thing that really came through was this "Go, go, go" chant. I was getting shoved around like a beanbag. The guy next to me either pissed himself or jacked off in his pants. You couldn't tell which. They walked right past me. One of them was a big blonde with his shirt open. One of his shoe soles had come unglued or unstitched or whatever, and it was flapping. The other guy wasn't even wearing his shoes anymore. He was in his stocking feet. His socks ended at his ankles. The rest of them, why, he'd just walked them away, hadn't he? His feet were purple. You could see the broken blood vessels in his feet. I don't think he really felt it anymore. Maybe they were able to do something with his feet later. I don't know. Maybe they were. "Stop it, for God's sake, stop it." It was McVries. He sounded dazed and sick. "You wanted to know," Stebbins said, almost genially. "Didn't you say that?" No answer. The half-track whined and clattered and spurted along the shoulder, and somewhere farther up, someone drew a warning. It was the big blonde that lost. I saw it all. They were just a little past me. He threw both of his arms up, like he was Superman, but instead of flying, he just fell flat on his face, and they gave him his ticket after 30 seconds because he was walking with three. They were both walking with three. Then the crowd started to cheer. They cheered and they cheered, and then they could see that the kid that won was trying to say something. So they shut up. He had fallen on his knees, you know, like he was going to pray, only he was just crying. And then he crawled over to the other boy and put his face in that big blonde kid's shirt. Then he started to say whatever it was he had to say, but we couldn't hear it. He was talking into the dead kid's shirt. He was telling the dead kid. Then the soldiers rushed out and told him he had won the prize and asked him how he wanted to start. "What did he say?" Garrity asked. It seemed to him that with the question, he had laid his whole life on the line. "He didn't say anything to them, not then," Stebbins said. "He was talking to the dead kid. He was telling the dead kid something, but we couldn't hear it."
"What happened then?" Pearson asked.
"I don't remember," Stebbins said remotely. No one said anything. Garrity felt a panicked, trapped sensation, as if someone had stuffed him into an underground pipe that was too small to get out of. Up ahead, a third warning was given out, and a boy made a croaking, despairing sound, like a dying crow. "Please, God, don't let them shoot anyone now," Garrity thought. "I'll go crazy if I hear the guns now. Please, God, please, God." A few minutes later, the guns rammed their steel death sound into the night. This time it was a short boy in a flapping red and white football jersey. For a moment, Garrity thought Percy's mom would not have to wonder or worry anymore, but it wasn't Percy. It was a boy named Quincy, or Quentin, or something like that. Garrity didn't go crazy. He turned around to say angry words at Stebbins, to ask him, perhaps, how it felt to inflict a boy's last minutes with such a horror. But Stebbins had dropped back to his usual position, and Garrity was alone again. They walked on, the 90 of them. Chapter 5. At 10:20 on that endless May 1st, Garrity sloughed one of his two warnings. Two more walkers had bought it since the boy in the football jersey. Garrity barely noticed.
He was taking a careful inventory of himself. One head, a little confused and crazied up, but basically okay. Two eyes, grainy. One neck, pretty stiff. Two arms, no problem there. One torso, okay except for a gnawing in his gut that concentrates couldn't satisfy. Two damn tired legs, muscles aching. He wondered how far his legs would carry him on their own, how long before his brain took them over and began punishing them, making them work past any sane limit to keep a bullet from crashing into his own bony cradle. How long before the legs began to kink and then to bind up, to protest and finally to seize up and stop. His legs were tired, but so far as he could tell, still pretty much okay. And 2 feet. Aching. They were tender, no use denying it. He was a big boy. Those feet were shifting 160 pounds back and forth. The soles ached. There were occasional strange shooting pains in them. His left great toe had poked through his sock. He thought of Stebbins's tail and felt a kind of creeping horror at that, and had begun to rub uncomfortably against his shoe. But his feet were working. There were still no blisters on them, and he felt his feet were still pretty much okay too. "Garrity," he pep-talked himself, "you're in good shape. 12 guys dead, twice that many, maybe hurting bad by now, but you're okay. You're going good. You're great. You're alive." Conversation, which had died violently at the end of Stebbins's story, picked up again. Talking was what living people did. Yannick, 98, was discussing the ancestry of the soldiers on the half-track in an overloud voice with Wyman, 97. Both agreed that it was mixed, colorful, hirsute, and bastardized. Pearson, meanwhile, abruptly asked Garrity, "Ever have an enema?" "Enema?" Garrity repeated. He thought about it. "No, I don't think so." "Any of you guys?" Pearson asked. "Tell the truth now." "I did," Harkness said, and chuckled a little. "My mother gave me one after Halloween once, when I was little. I ate pretty near a whole shopping bag of candy." "Did you like it?" Pearson pressed. "Hell no. Who in hell would like a half a quart of warm soap suds up your—" "My little brother," Pearson said sadly. "I asked the little snot if he was sorry I was going, and he said no, because Ma said he could have an enema if he was good and didn't cry. He loves them." "That's sickening," Harkness said loudly. Pearson looked glum. "I thought so too." A few minutes later, Davidson joined the group and told them about the times he got drunk at the Steubenville State Fair and crawled into the Hoochie Cooch tent and got biffed in the head by a big fat mama wearing nothing but a G-string. When Davidson told her, so he said, that he was drunk and thought it was the tattooing tent he was crawling into, the red-hot big fat mama let him feel her up for a while, so he said. He had told her he wanted to get a stars and bars tattooed on his stomach. Art Baker told them about a contest they'd had back home to see who could light the biggest fart, and this hairy-assed old boy named Davy Popham had managed to burn off almost all the hair on his ass and the small of his back as well. Smelled like a grass fire, Baker said. This got Harkness laughing so hard, he drew a warning. After that, the race was on. Tall story followed tall story until the whole shaky structure came tumbling down. Someone else was warned, and not long after, the other baker, James, bought a ticket. The good humor went out of the group. Some of them began to talk about their girlfriends, and the conversation became stumbling and maudlin. Garrity said nothing about Jan, but as tired 10 o'clock came rolling in, a black coal sack splattered with milky ground mist, it seemed to him that she was the best thing he had ever known. They passed under a short string of mercury streetlights, through a closed and shuttered town, all of them subdued now, speaking in low murmurs. In front of the Shopwell, near the far end of this wide place in the road, a young couple sat asleep on a sidewalk bench with their heads leaning together. A sign that could not be read dangled between them. The girl was very young, she looked no more than 14, and her boyfriend was wearing a sport shirt that had been washed too many times to ever look very sporty again. Their shadows in the street made a merge that the walkers passed quietly over. Garrity glanced back over his shoulder, quite sure that the rumble of the half-track must have awakened them. But they still slept, unaware that the event had come and passed them by. He wondered if the girl would catch what for from her old man. She looked awfully young. He wondered if their sign was for Go Go Garrity, Maine's Own. Somehow, he hoped not. Somehow, the idea was a little repulsive. He ate the last of his concentrates and felt a little better. There was nothing left for Olson to cadge off him now. It was funny about Olson. Garrity would have bet 6 hours ago that Olson was pretty well done in. But he was still walking, and now without warnings. Garrity supposed a person could do a lot of things when his life was at stake. They had come about 54 miles now. The last of the talk died with the nameless town. They marched in silence for an hour or so, and the chill began to seep into Garrity again. He ate the last of his mom's cookies, balled up the foil, and pitched it into the brush at the side of the road. Just another litter bug on the great tomato plant of life. McVries had produced a toothbrush, of all things, from his small pack sack, and was busy dry brushing his teeth. It all goes on, Garrity thought wonderingly. You burp, you say excuse me. You wave back at the people who wave to you because that's the polite thing to do. No one argues very much with anyone else, except for Barkovich, because that's also the polite thing to do. It all goes on. Or did it? He thought of McVries sobbing at Stebbins to shut up, of Olson taking his cheese with the dumb humility of a whipped dog. It all seemed to have a heightened intensity about it, a sharper contrast of colors and light and shadow. At 11 o'clock, several things happened almost at once. The word came back that a small plank bridge up ahead had been washed out by a heavy afternoon thunderstorm. With the bridge out, the walk would have to be temporarily stopped. A weak cheer went up through the ragged ranks, and Olson, in a very soft voice, muttered, "Thank God." A moment later, Barkovich began to scream a flood of profanity at the boy next to him, a squat, ugly boy with the unfortunate name of Rank. Rank took a swing at him, something expressly forbidden by the rules, and was warned for it. Barkovich didn't even break stride. He simply lowered his head and ducked under the punch and went on yelling.
"Come on, you son of a bitch! I'll dance on your goddamn grave! Come on, Dumbo, pick up your feet! Don't make it too easy for me!"
Rank threw another punch. Barkovich nimbly stepped around it, but tripped over the boy walking next to him. They were both warned by the soldiers, who were now watching the developments carefully, but emotionlessly, like men watching a couple of ants squabbling over a crumb of bread, Garrity thought bitterly. Rank started to walk faster, not looking at Barkovich. Barkovich himself, furious at being warned, the boy he had tripped over was Gribble, who had wanted to tell the major he was a murderer, yelled at him,
"Your mother sucks cock on 42nd Street, Rank!"
With that, Rank suddenly turned around and charged Barkovich. Cries of,
"Break it up!"
and
"Cut the shit!"
filled the air, but Rank took no notice. He went for Barkovich with his head down, bellowing. Barkovich sidestepped him. Rank went stumbling and pinwheeling across the soft shoulder, skidded in the sand, and sat down with his feet splayed out. He was given a third warning.
Come on, Dumbo,
Barkovich goaded.
Get up!
Rank did get up. Then he slipped somehow and fell over on his back. He seemed dazed and woozy. The third thing that happened around 11 o'clock was Rank's death. There was a moment of silence when the carbine sighted in, and Baker's voice was loud and clearly audible.
There, Barkovich, you're not a pest anymore. Now you're a murderer.
The guns roared. Rank's body was thrown into the air by the force of the bullets. Then it lay still and sprawled, one arm on the road.
It was his own fault,
Barkovich yelled.
You saw him. He swung first. Rule 8, Rule 8.
No one said anything.
Go fuck yourselves, all of you,
McVries said easily. Go on back and dance on him a little, Barkovich. Go entertain us. Boogie on him a little bit, Barkovich.
Your mother sucks cock on 42nd Street too, Scarface,
Barkovich said hoarsely. Can't wait to see your brains all over the road, McVries said quietly. His hand had gone to the scar and was rubbing, rubbing, rubbing. I'll cheer when it happens, you murdering little bastard. Barkovich muttered something else under his breath. The others had shied away from him as if he had the plague and he was walking by himself. They hit 60 miles at about 10 past 11, with no sign of a bridge of any kind. Garrity was beginning to think the grapevine had been wrong this time when they cleared a small hill and looked down into a pool of light where a small crowd of hustling, bustling men moved. The lights were the beams of several trucks, directed at a plank bridge spanning a fast-running rill of water.
Truly, I love that bridge, Olson said, and helped himself to one of McVree's cigarettes. Truly.
But as they drew closer, Olson made a soft, ugly sound in his throat and pitched the cigarette away into the weeds. One of the bridge's supports and two of the heavy butt planks had been washed away, but the squad up ahead had been working diligently. A sawed-off telephone pole had been planted in the bed of the stream, anchored in what looked like a gigantic cement plug. They hadn't had a chance to replace the butts, so they had put down a big convoy truck tailgate in their place. Makeshift, but it would serve.
The bridge of San Luis Rey, Abraham said. Maybe if the ones up front stomp a little, it'll collapse again.
Small chance, Pearson said, and then added in a breaking, weepy voice. Aw, shit.
The vanguard, down to 3 or 4 boys, was on the bridge now. Their feet clumped hollowly as they crossed. Then they were on the other side, walking without looking back. The half-track stopped. 2 soldiers jumped out and kept pace with the boys. On the other side of the bridge, 2 more fell in with the vanguard. The boards rumbled steadily now. 2 men in corduroy coats leaned against a big asphalt-spattered truck marked Highway Repair. They were smoking. They wore green gum-rubber boots. They watched the walkers go by. As Davidson, McVries, Olson, Pearson, Harkness, Baker, and Garrity passed in a loose sort of group, one of them flicked his cigarette end over end into the stream and said,
"That's him. That's Garrity."
"Keep going, boy," the other yelled. "I got 10 bucks on you at 12 to 1.
Garrity noticed a few sawdusty lengths of telephone pole in the back of the truck. They were the ones who had made sure he was going to keep going, whether he liked it or not. He raised 1 hand to them and crossed the bridge. The tailgate that had replaced the butt planks clunked under his shoes, and then the bridge was behind them. The road dog-legged, and the only reminder of the rest they'd almost had was a wedge-shaped swath of light on the trees at the side of the road. Soon, that was gone too.
"Has a long walk ever been stopped for anything?" Harkness asked.
I don't think so, Garrity said. More material for the book? No, Harkness said. He sounded tired. Just personal information. It stops every year, Stebbins said from behind them. Once. There was no reply to that. About half an hour later, McVries came up beside Garrity and walked with him in silence for a little while. Then, very quietly, he said, Do you think you'll win, Ray? Garrity considered it for a long, long time. No, he said finally. No. The stark admission frightened him. He thought again about buying a ticket. No, buying a bullet. Of the final frozen half-second of total knowledge, seeing the bottomless bores of the carbines swing toward him, legs frozen, guts crawling and clawing, muscles, genitals, brain, all cowering away from the oblivion, a bloodbead away. He swallowed dryly. How about yourself? I guess not, McVries said. I stopped thinking I had any real chance around 9 tonight. You see, He cleared his throat. It's hard to say, but I went into it with my eyes open, you know? He gestured around himself at the other boys. Lots of these guys didn't, you know? I knew the odds, but I didn't figure on people. And I don't think I ever realized the real gut truth of what this is. I think I had the idea that when the first guy got so he couldn't cut it anymore, they'd aim the guns at him and pull the triggers, and little pieces of paper with the word bang printed on them would, and the major would say April Fool, and we'd all go home. Do you get what I'm saying at all? Garrity thought of his own rending shock when Curly had gone down in a spray of blood and brains like oatmeal, brains on the pavement and the white line. Yes, he said. I know what you're saying. It took me a while to figure it out, but it was faster after I got around that mental block. Walk or die, that's the moral of this story. Simple as that. It's not survival of the physically fittest. That's where I went wrong when I let myself get into this. If it was, I'd have a fair chance. But there are weak men who can lift cars if their wives are pinned underneath. The brain, Garrity. McVries' voice had dropped to a hoarse whisper. It isn't man or God. It's something in the brain. A whippoorwill called once in the darkness. The ground fog was lifting. Some of these guys will go on walking long after the laws of biochemistry and handicapping have gone by the boards. There was a guy last year that crawled for 2 miles at 4 miles an hour after both of his feet cramped up at the same time. You remember reading about that? Look at Olsen. He's worn out, but he keeps going. That goddamn Barkovich is running on high-octane hate, and he just keeps going, and he's as fresh as a daisy. I don't think I can do that. I'm not tired, not really tired, yet. But I will be. The scar stood out on the side of his haggard face as he looked ahead into the darkness. And I think, when I get tired enough, I think I'll just sit down. Garrity was silent, but he felt alarmed, very alarmed. I'll outlast Barkovich, though, McVries said, almost to himself. I can do that, by Christ. Garrity glanced at his watch and saw it was 11:30. They passed through a deserted crossroads where a sleepy-looking constable was parked. The possible traffic he had been sent out to halt was non-existent. They walked past him, out of the bright circle of light thrown by the single mercury lamp.
Darkness fell over them like a coal sack again.
"We could slip into the woods now, and they'd never see us," Garrity said thoughtfully.
"Try it," Olson said. "They've got infrared sweep scopes, along with 40 other kinds of monitoring gear, including high-intensity microphones. They hear everything we're saying. They can almost pick up your heartbeat. And they see you like daylight, Ray."
As if to emphasize his point, a boy behind them was given a second warning.
"You take all the fun out of living," Baker said softly. His faint southern drawl sounded out of place and foreign to Garrity's ears.
McVries had walked away. The darkness seemed to isolate each of them, and Garrity felt a shaft of intense loneliness. There were mutters and half-yelps every time something crashed through the woods they were going past, and Garrity realized, with some amusement, that a late evening stroll through the main woods could be no picnic for the city boys and the crew. An owl made a mysterious noise somewhere to their left. On the other side, something rustled, was still, rustled again, was still, and then made a crashing break for less populated acreage. There was another nervous cry of, "What was that?" Overhead, capricious spring clouds began to scud across the sky in mackerel shapes, promising more rain. Garrity turned up his collar and listened to the sound of his feet pounding the pavement. There was a trick to that, a subtle mental adjustment, like having better night vision the longer you were in the dark. This morning, the sound of his feet had been lost to him. They had been lost in the tramp of 99 other pairs, not to mention the rumble of the half-track. But now he heard them easily. His own particular stride, and the way his left foot scraped the pavement every now and then. It seemed to him that the sound of his footfalls had become as loud to his ears as the sound of his own heartbeat. Vital, life and death sound. His eyes felt grainy, trapped in their sockets. The lids were heavy. His energy seemed to be draining down some sinkhole in the middle of him. Warnings were droned out with monotonous regularity, but no one was shot. Barkovich had shut up. Stebbins was a ghost again, not even visible in back of them. The hands on his watch read 11:40. On up toward the hour of witches, he thought. When churchyards yawn and give up their moldy dead, when all good little boys are sacked out, when wives and lovers have given up the carnal pillow fight for the evening, when passengers sleep uneasy on the Greyhound to New York, when Glenn Miller plays uninterrupted on the radio and bartenders think about putting the chairs up on the tables, and... Jan's face came into his mind again. He thought of kissing her at Christmas, almost half a year ago, under the plastic mistletoe his mother always hung from the big light globe in the kitchen. Stupid kid stuff. "Look where you're standing." Her lips had been surprised and soft, not resisting. A nice kiss. One to dream on. His first real kiss. He did it again when he took her home. They had been standing in her driveway, standing in the silent grayness of falling Christmas snow. That had been something more than a nice kiss. His arms around her waist, her arms around his neck, locked there, her eyes closed, he had peeked, the soft feel of her breasts, muffled up in her coat, of course, against him. He had almost told her he loved her then, but no, that would have been too quick. After that, they taught each other. She taught him that books were sometimes just to be read and discarded, not studied. He was something of a grind, which amused Jan, and her amusement first exasperated him, and then he also saw the funny side of it. He taught her to knit. That had been a funny thing. His father, of all people, had taught him how to knit, before the squads got him. His father had taught Garrity's father as well. It was something of a male tradition in the Clan Garrity, it seemed. Jan had been fascinated by the pattern of the increases and decreases, and she left him behind soon enough, overstepping his laborious scarves and mittens to sweaters, cable knits, and finally to crocheting, and even the tatting of doilies, which she gave up as ridiculous as soon as the skill was mastered. He had also taught her how to rumba and cha-cha, skills he had learned on endless Saturday mornings at Mrs. Amelia Dorgenson's School for Modern Dance. That had been his mother's idea, one he had objected to strenuously. His mother had stuck to her guns, thank God. He thought now of the patterns of light and shadow on the nearly perfect oval of her face, the way she walked, the lift and fall of her voice, the easy, desirable swing of one hip, and he wondered in terror what he was doing here, walking down this dark road. He wanted her now. He wanted to do it all over again, but differently. Now, when he thought of the major's tanned face, the salt and pepper mustache, the mirrored sunglasses, he felt a horror so deep it made his legs feel rubbery and weak. "Why am I here?" he asked himself desperately, and there was no answer. So he asked the question again. "Why am—" The guns crashed in the darkness, and there was the unmistakable mail sack thud of a body falling on the concrete. The fear was on him again, the hot, throat-choking fear that made him want to run blindly, to dive into the bushes and just keep on running until he found Jan and safety. McVries had Barkovich to keep him going. He would concentrate on Jan. He would walk to Jan. They reserved space for Long Walker's relatives and loved ones in the front lines. He would see her. He thought about kissing that other girl and was ashamed. How do you know you'll make it? A cramp, blisters, a bad cut or a nosebleed that just won't quit, a big hill that was just too big and too long. How do you know you'll make it? I'll make it. I'll make it. Congratulations, McVries said at his shoulder, making him jump. Huh? It's midnight. We live to fight another day, Garrity.
And many of them, Abraham added. For me, that is. Not that I begrudge you, you understand.
105 miles to Old Town, if you care, Olson put in tiredly.
Who gives a shit about Old Town? McVries demanded. You ever been there, Garrity?
No.
How about Augusta? Christ, I thought that was in Georgia.
Yeah, I've been in Augusta. It's the state capital.
Regional, Abraham said.
And the corporate governor's mansion, and a couple of traffic circles, and a couple of movies.
You have those in Maine? McVries asked.
Well, it's a small state capital, okay? Garrity said, smiling.
Wait till we hit Boston, McVries said.
There were groans. From up ahead, there came cheers, shouts, and catcalls.
Garrity was alarmed to hear his own name called out. Up ahead, about half a mile away, was a ramshackle farmhouse, deserted and fallen down. But a battered Klieg light had been plugged in somewhere, and a huge sign, lettered with pine boughs across the front of the house, read,
"Garrity's our man. Aroostook County Parents Association."
"Hey, Garrity, where's the parents?" someone yelled.
"Back home making kids," Garrity said, embarrassed. There could be no doubt that Maine was Garrity country, but he found the signs and cheers and the jibes of the others all a little mortifying. He had found, among other things, in the last 15 hours, that he didn't much crave the limelight. The thought of a million people all over the state rooting for him and laying bets on him at 12-1, the highway worker had said. Was that good or bad? Was a little scary.
You'd think they would have left a few plump, juicy parents lying around somewhere, Davidson said. Poontang from the PTA? Abraham asked.
The ribbing was half-hearted and didn't last very long. The road killed most ribbing very quickly. They crossed another bridge, this time a cement one that spanned a good-sized river. The water rippled below them like black silk. A few crickets chirred cautiously, and around 15 past midnight, a spatter of light, cold rain fell. Up ahead, someone began to play a harmonica. It didn't last long, hint 6, conserve wind, but it was pretty for the moment it lasted. It sounded a little like old Black Joe, Garrity thought. Down in de cornfield, hear dat mournful sound. All de darkies am a-weeping, Ewing's in de cold, cold ground. No, that wasn't old Black Joe. That tune was some other Shepherd Foster racist classic. Good old Stephen Foster. Drank himself to death. So did Poe, it had been reputed. Poe the necrophiliac, the one who had married his 14-year-old cousin. That made him a pedophile as well. All around depraved fellows, he and Stephen Foster both. If only they could have lived to see the long walk, Garrity thought. They could have collaborated on the world's first morbid musical. Masses on the cold, cold road, or the tell-tell stride, or... Up ahead, someone began to scream, and Garrity felt his blood go cold. It was a very young voice. It was not screaming words. It was only screaming. A dark figure broke from the pack, pelted across the shoulder of the road in front of the half-track. Garrity could not even remember when the half-track had rejoined their march after the repaired bridge, and dived for the woods. The guns roared. There was a rending crash as a dead weight fell through the juniper bushes and underbrush to the ground. One of the soldiers jumped down and dragged the inert form up by the hands. Garrity watched apathetically and thought, even the horror wears thin. There's a surfeit, even of death. The harmonica player started in satirically on taps, and somebody, Collie Parker by the sound, told him angrily to shut the fuck up. Stebbins laughed. Garrity felt suddenly furious with Stebbins and wanted to turn to him and ask him how he'd like someone laughing at his death. It was something you'd expect of Barkovich. Barkovich had said he'd dance on a lot of graves, and there were 16 he could dance on already. I doubt that he'll have much left of his feet to dance with, Garrity thought. A sharp twinge of pain went through the arch of his right foot. The muscle there tightened heart-stoppingly, then loosened. Garrity waited with his heart in his mouth for it to happen again. It would hit harder. It would turn his foot into a block of useless wood. But it didn't happen.
I can't walk much further,
Olson croaked. His face was a white blur in the darkness. No one answered him. The darkness. God damn the darkness. It seemed to Garrity they had been buried alive in it, immured in it. Dawn was a century away. Many of them would never see the dawn. Or the sun. They were buried 6 feet deep in the darkness. All they needed was the monotonous chanting of the priest, his voice muffled but not entirely obscured by the new packed darkness, above which the mourners stood. The mourners were not even aware that they were here. They were alive. They were screaming and scratching and clawing at the coffin-lid darkness. The air was flaking and rusting away. The air was turning into poison gas. Hope fading until hope itself was a darkness. And above all of it, the nodding chapel bell voice of the priest and the impatient shuffling feet of mourners anxious to be off into the warm May sunshine. Then, overmastering that, the sighing, shuffling chorus of the bugs and the beetles squirming their way through the earth, come for the feast. I could go crazy, Garrity thought. I could go right the fuck off my rocker. A little breeze soughed through the pines. Garrity turned around and urinated. Stebbins moved over a little and Harkness made a coughing, snoring sound. He was walking half asleep. Garrity became acutely conscious of all the little sounds of life. Someone hawked and spat. Someone else sneezed. Someone ahead and to the left was chewing something noisily. Someone asked someone else softly how he felt. There was a murmured answer. Yannick was singing at a whisper level, soft, and very much off-key. Awareness. It was all a function of awareness. But it wasn't forever.
"Why did I get into this?"
Olson suddenly asked hopelessly, echoing Garrity's thoughts not so many minutes ago.
"Why did I let myself in for this?"
No one answered him. No one had answered him for a long time now. Garrity thought it was as if Olson were already dead. Another light spatter of rain fell. They passed another ancient graveyard, a church next door, a tiny shop front, and then they were walking through a small New England community of small, neat homes. The road crosshatched a miniature business section where perhaps a dozen people had gathered to watch them pass. They cheered, but it was a subdued sound, as if they were afraid they might wake their neighbors. None of them was young, Garrity saw. The youngest was an intense-eyed man of about 35. He was wearing rimless glasses and a shabby sport coat, pulled against him to protect against the chill. His hair stuck up and back, and Garrity noted with amusement that his fly was half unzipped.
"Go, great, go, go, oh, great," he chanted softly.
He waved one soft, plump hand ceaselessly, and his eyes seemed to burn over each of them as they passed. On the far side of the village, a sleepy-eyed policeman held up a rumbling trailer truck until they had passed. There were four more streetlights, an abandoned, crumbling building with Eureka Grange number 81 written over the big double doors at the front, and then the town was gone. For no reason Garrity could put a finger on, he felt as if he had just walked through a Shirley Jackson short story. McVries nudged him. "Look at that dude," he said. That dude was a tall boy in a ridiculous loden green trench coat. It flapped around his knees. He was walking with his arms wrapped around his head like a gigantic poultice. He was weaving unsteadily back and forth. Garrity watched him closely with a kind of academic interest. He couldn't recall ever having seen this particular walker before, but of course the darkness changed faces. The boy stumbled over one of his own feet and almost fell down. Then he went on walking. Garrity and McVries watched him in fascinated silence for perhaps 10 minutes, losing their own aches and tiredness in the trench-coated boy's struggle. The boy in the trench coat didn't make a sound, not a groan or a moan. Finally, he did fall over and was warned. Garrity didn't think the boy would be able to get up. But he did. Now he was walking almost with Garrity and the boys around him. He was an extremely ugly boy, with a number 45 pressure taped to his coat. Olson whispered, "What's the matter with you?" But the boy seemed not to hear. They got that way, Garrity had noticed. Complete withdrawal from everything and everyone around them. Everything but the road. They stared at the road with a kind of horrid fascination, as if it were a tightrope they had to walk over an endless bottomless chasm. "What's your name?" he asked the boy, but there was no answer. And he found himself suddenly spitting the question at the boy over and over, like an idiot litany that would save him from whatever fate was coming for him out of the darkness like a black express freight. "What's your name, huh? What's your name? What's your name? What's..." "Ray." McVries was tugging at his sleeve. "He won't tell me, Pete. Make him tell me. Make him say his name." "Don't bother him," McVries said. "He's dying. Don't bother him." The boy with 45 on his trench coat fell over again, this time on his face.
When he got up, there were scratches on his forehead, slowly welling blood. He was behind Garrity's group now, but they heard it when he got his final warning. They passed through a hollow of deeper darkness that was a railroad overpass. Rain dripped somewhere, hollow and mysterious in this stone throat. It was very damp. Then they were out again, and Garrity saw with gratitude that there was a long, straight, flat stretch ahead. 45 fell down again. Footsteps quickened as boys scattered. Not long after, the guns roared. Garrity decided the boy's name must not have been important anyway. Chapter 6 3:30 in the morning. To Ray Garrity, it seemed the longest minute of the longest night of his entire life. It was low tide, dead ebb, the time when the sea washes back, leaving slick mud flats covered with straggled weed, rusty beer cans, rotted prophylactics, broken bottles, smashed buoys, and green mossed skeletons and tattered bathing trunks. It was dead ebb. 7 more had gotten tickets since the boy in the trench coat. At one time, around 2 in the morning, 3 had gone down almost together, like dried corn shocks in the first hard autumn wind. They were 75 miles into the walk, and there were 24 gone. But none of that mattered. All that mattered was dead ebb. 3:30 and the dead ebb. Another warning was given, and shortly after, the guns crashed once more. This time the face was a familiar one. It was 8, Davidson, who claimed he had once sneaked into the Hoochie Cooch tent at the Steubenville State Fair. Garrity looked at Davidson's white, blood-spattered face for just a moment, and then he looked back at the road. He looked at the road quite a lot now. Sometimes the white line was solid, sometimes it was broken, and sometimes it was double, like streetcar tracks. He wondered how people could ride over this road all the other days of the year and not see the pattern of life and death in that white paint. Or did they see, after all? The pavement fascinated him. How good and easy it would be to sit on that pavement. You'd start by squatting, and your stiff knee joints would pop like toy air pistols. Then you'd put bracing hands back on the cool, pebbled surface and snuggle your buttocks down. You'd feel the screaming pressure of your 160 pounds leave your feet. And then to lie down, just fall backward and lie there, spread-eagled, feeling your tired spine stretch, looking up at the encircling trees and the majestic wheel of the stars, not hearing the warnings, just watching the sky and waiting, waiting. Yeah. Hearing the scatter of footsteps as walkers moved out of the line of fire, leaving him alone like a sacrificial offering. Hearing the whispers, "It's Garrity. Hey, it's Garrity getting a ticket." Perhaps there would be time to hear Barkovich laugh as he strapped on his metaphorical dancing shoes one more time. The swing of the carbines zeroing in. Then he tore his glance forcibly from the road and stared blearily at the moving shadows around him, then looked up at the horizon, hunting for even a trace of dawn light. There was none, of course. The night was still dark. They had passed through 2 or 3 more small towns, all of them dark and closed. Since midnight, they had passed maybe 3 dozen sleepy spectators, the die-hard type who grimly watch in the new year each December 31st, come hell or high water. The rest of the last 3.5 hours was nothing but a dream montage, an insomniac's half-sleeping wake-mere. Garrity looked more closely at the faces around him, but none seemed familiar. An irrational panic stole over him. He tapped the shoulder of the walker in front of him. "Pete? Pete, that you?"
The figure slipped away from him with an irritated grunt and didn't look back. Olson had been on his left, Baker on his right, but now there was no one at all on his left side, and the boy to his right was much chubbier than Art Baker. Somehow he had wandered off the road and fallen in with a bunch of late-hiking boy scouts. They would be looking for him, hunting for him. Guns and dogs and squads with radar and heat tracers and... Relief washed over him. That was Abraham, up ahead at 4 o'clock. All he'd had to do was turn his head a little. The gangling form was unmistakable.
Abraham, he stage whispered. Abraham, you awake?
Abraham muttered something.
I said, you awake?
Yes, goddammit, Garrity, leave me alone.
At least he was still with them. That feeling of total disorientation passed away. Someone up ahead was given a third warning, and Garrity thought,
I don't have any. I could sit down for a minute, or a minute and a half. I could...
But he'd never get up.
Yes, I would, he answered himself. Sure I would. I'd just die.
He remembered promising his mother that he would see her and Jan in Freeport. He had made the promise lightheartedly, almost carelessly. At 9 o'clock yesterday morning, his arrival in Freeport had been a foregone conclusion. But it wasn't a game anymore. It was a three-dimensional reality, and the possibility of walking into Freeport on nothing but a pair of bloody stumps seemed a horribly possible possibility. Someone else was shot down. Behind him, this time. The aim was bad, and the unlucky ticket holder screamed hoarsely for what seemed a very long time before another bullet cut off the sound. For no reason at all, Garrity thought of bacon, and heavy, sour spit came into his mouth and made him feel like gagging. Garrity wondered if 26 down was an unusually high or an unusually low number for 75 miles into a long walk. His head dropped slowly between his shoulders, and his feet carried them forward on their own. He thought about a funeral he had gone to as a boy. It had been Freaky D'Alessio's funeral. Not that his real name had been Freaky. His real name had been George, but all the kids in the neighborhood called him Freaky because his eyes didn't quite jibe. He could remember Freaky waiting to be picked up for baseball games, always coming in dead last, his out-of-kilter eyes switching hopefully from one team captain to the other like a spectator at a tennis match. He always stayed deep center field, where not too many balls were hit, and he couldn't do much damage. One of his eyes was almost blind, and he didn't have enough depth perception to judge any balls hit to him. Once he got under one and jabbed his glove at a hunk of thin air while the ball landed on his forehead with an audible bonk, like a cantaloupe being walked with the handle of a kitchen knife. The threads on the ball left an imprint dead square on his forehead for a week, like a brand. Freaky was killed by a car on US-1 outside of Freeport. One of Garrity's friends, Eddie Klipstein, saw it happen. He held kids in thrall for 6 weeks, Eddie Klipstein did, telling them about how the car hit Freaky D'Alessio's bike and Freaky went up over the handlebars, knocked spang out of his shit-kicker boots by the impact, both of his legs flailing out behind him in crippled splendor as his body flew its short, wingless flight from the seat of his Schwinn to a stone wall where Freaky landed and spread his head like a dollop of wet glue on the rocks. He went to Freaky's funeral, and before they got there, he almost lost his lunch, wondering if he would see Freaky's head spread in the coffin like a glob of Elmer's glue. But Freaky was all fixed up in his sport coat and tie and his Cub Scouts attendance pin, and he looked ready to step out of his coffin the moment someone said baseball. The eyes that didn't jibe were closed, and in general, Garrity felt pretty relieved. That had been the only dead person he had ever seen before all of this, and it had been a clean, neat dead person. Nothing like Ewing,
or the boy in the loden trench coat, or Davidson with blood on his livid, tired face. It's sick, Garrity thought with dismal realization. It's just sick. At 3:45, he was given first warning, and he slapped himself twice smartly across the face, trying to make himself wake up. His body felt chilled clear through. His kidneys dragged at him, but at the same time he felt that he didn't quite have to pee yet. It might have been his imagination, but the stars in the east seemed a trifle paler. With real amazement, it occurred to him that at this time yesterday, he had been asleep in the back of the car as they drove up toward the stone marking post at the border. He could almost see himself stretched out on his back, sprawling there, not even moving. He felt an intense longing to be back there, just to bring back yesterday morning. 3:50 now. He looked around himself, getting a superior, lonely kind of gratification from knowing he was one of the few fully awake and aware. It was definitely lighter now, light enough to make out snatches of features in the walking silhouettes. Baker was up ahead. He could tell it was him by the flapping red striped shirt. And McVries was behind him. He saw Olson was off to the left, keeping pace with the half track, and was surprised. He was sure that Olson had been one of those to get tickets during the small hours of the morning, and had been relieved that he hadn't had to see Hank go down. It was too dark even now to see how he looked, but Olson's head was bouncing up and down in time to his stride like the head of a rag doll. Percy, whose mom kept showing up, was back by Stebbins now. Percy was walking with a kind of lopsided roll, like a long-time sailor on his first day ashore. He also spotted Gribble, Harkness, Wyman, and Collie Parker. Most of the people he knew were still in it. By 4:00, there was a brightening band on the horizon, and Garrity felt his spirits lift. He stared back at the long tunnel of the night in actual horror and wondered how he ever could have gotten through it. He stepped up his pace a little, approaching McVries, who was walking with his chin against his breast, his eyes half open, but glazed and vacant, more asleep than awake. A thin, delicate cord of saliva hung from the corner of his mouth, picking up the first tremulous touch of dawn with pearly, beautiful fidelity. Garrity stared at this strange phenomenon, fascinated. He didn't want to wake McVries out of his doze. For the time being, it was enough to be close to someone he liked, someone else who had made it through the night. They passed a rocky, steeply slanting meadow where 5 cows stood gravely at a bark-peeled pole fence, staring out at the walkers and chewing thoughtfully. A small dog tore out of a farmyard and barked at them ratchetingly. The soldiers on the half-track raised their guns to high post, ready to shoot the animal if he interfered with any walker's progress, but the dog only chased back and forth along the shoulder, bravely voicing defiance and territoriality from a safe distance. Someone yelled thickly at him to shut up, goddammit. Garrity became entranced with the coming dawn. He watched as the sky and the land lightened by degrees. He watched the white band on the horizon deepen a delicate pink, then red, then gold. The guns roared once more before the last of the night was finally banished, but Garrity barely heard. The first red arc of sun was peering over the horizon, faded behind a fluff of cloud, then came again in an onslaught. It looked to be a perfect day, and Garrity greeted it only half coherently by thinking, "Thank God I can die in the daylight." A bird twittered sleepily. They passed another farmhouse where a man with a beard waved at them after putting down a wheelbarrow filled with hoes, rakes, and planting seed. A crow cawed raucously off in the shadowy woods. The first heat of the day touched Garrity's face gently, and he welcomed it. He grinned and yelled loudly for a canteen.
McVries twitched his head oddly, like a dog interrupted in a dream of cat chasing, and then looked around with muddy eyes.
My God, daylight. Daylight, Garrity. What time?
Garrity looked at his watch and was surprised to find it was 4:45. He showed McVries the dial.
How many miles? Any idea?
About 80, I make it, and 27 down. We're 1/4 of the way home, Pete.
Yeah,
McVries smiled.
That's right, isn't it?
Damn right. You feel better? Garrity asked.
About 1,000%.
So do I. I think it's the daylight.
My God, I bet we see some people today. Did you read that article in World's Week about the long walk?
Skimmed it, Garrity said, mostly to see my name in print. Said that over $2 billion gets bet on the long walk every year.
$2 billion.
Baker had awakened from his own doze and had joined them. We used to have a pool in my high school, he said. Everybody'd kick in 1/4, and then we'd each pick a 3-digit number out of a hat. And the guy holding the number closest to the last mile of the walk, he got the money.
Olson, McVries yelled over cheerily. Just think of all the cash riding on you, boy. Think of the people with a bundle resting right on your skinny ass.
Olson told him in a tired, washed-out voice that the people with a bundle wagered on his skinny ass could perform 2 obscene acts upon themselves, the second proceeding directly from the first. McVries, Baker, and Garrity laughed.
Be a lot of pretty girls on the road today, Baker said, eyeing Garrity roguishly.
I'm all done with that stuff, Garrity said. I got a girl up ahead. I'm going to be a good boy from now on.
Sinless in thought, word, and deed, McVries said sententiously.
Garrity shrugged. See it any way you like, he said.
Chances are 100 to 1 against you ever having a chance to do more than wave to her again, McVries said flatly. 73 to 1 now.
Still pretty high.
But Garrity's good humor was solid.
I feel like I could walk forever, he said blandly. A couple of the walkers around him grimaced.
They passed an all-night gas station, and the attendant came out to wave. Just about everyone waved back. The attendant was calling encouragement to Wayne, 94, in particular.
Garrity, McVries said quietly.
What?
I couldn't tell all the guys that bought it. Could you?
No.
Barkovich?
No, up ahead, in front of Scram. See him?
McVries looked.
Oh. Yeah, I think I do.
Stebbins is still back there, too.
Not surprised. Funny guy, isn't he?
Yeah.
There was silence between them. McVries sighed deeply and unshouldered his knapsack and pulled out some macaroons. He offered one to Garrity, who took one.
I wish this was over, he said. One way or the other.
They ate their macaroons in silence.
We must be halfway to Old Town, huh? McVries said.
80 down, 80 to go?
I guess so, Garrity said.
Won't get there until tonight, then.
The mention of night made Garrity's flesh crawl.
No, he said, then abruptly. How'd you get that scar, Pete?
McVries' hand went involuntarily to his cheek in the scar.
It's a long story, he said briefly.
Garrity took a closer look at him. His hair was rumpled and clotty with dust and sweat. His clothes were limp and wrinkled. His face was pallid and his eyes were deeply circled in their bloodshot orbs. "You look like shit," he said, and suddenly burst out laughing. McVries grinned.
"You don't exactly look like a deodorant ad yourself, Ray."
They both laughed then, long and hysterically, clutching each other and trying to keep walking at the same time. It was as good a way as any to put an end to the night once and for all. It went on until Garrity and McVries were both warned. They stopped laughing and talking then, and settled into the day's business.
Thinking, Garrity thought. That's the day's business. Thinking. Thinking in isolation, because it doesn't matter if you pass the time of day with someone or not. In the end, you're alone.
He seemed to have put in as many miles in his brain as he had with his feet. The thoughts kept coming, and there was no way to deny them. It was enough to make you wonder what Socrates had thought about right after he had tossed off his hemlock cocktail. At a little past 5 o'clock, they passed their first clump of bona fide spectators, 4 little boys sitting cross-legged like Indians outside a pup tent in a dewy field. One was still wrapping up his sleeping bag, as solemn as an Eskimo. Their hands went back and forth like timed metronomes. None of them smiled. Shortly afterward, the road forked into another, larger road. This one was a smooth, wide expanse of asphalt, 3 lanes wide. They passed a truck stop restaurant, and everyone whistled and waved at the 3 young waitresses sitting on the steps, just to show them they were still starchy. The only one who sounded halfway serious was Collie Parker.
"Friday night," Collie yelled loudly. "Keep it in mind, you and me, Friday night."
Garrity thought they were all acting a little immature, but he waved politely and the waitresses seemed not to mind. The walkers spread out across the wider road as more of them came fully awake to the May 2nd morning sunshine. Garrity caught sight of Barkovich again and wondered if Barkovich wasn't really one of the smart ones. With no friends, you had no grief. A few minutes later, the word came back, and this time the word was a knock-knock joke. Bruce Pastor, the boy just in front of Garrity, turned around to Garrity and said,
"Knock-knock, Garrity."
"Who's there?"
"Major."
"Major who?"
"Major buggers his mother before breakfast," Bruce Pastor said, and laughed uproariously.
Garrity chuckled and passed it back to McVries, who passed it to Olson. When the joke came back the second time, the major was buggering his grandmother before breakfast. The third time, he was buggering Sheila, the Bedlington Terrier that appeared with him in so many of his press releases. Garrity was still laughing over that one when he noticed that McVries's laughter had tapered off and disappeared. He was staring with an odd fixity at the wooden-faced soldiers atop the half-track. They were staring back impassively.
"You think that's funny?"
he yelled suddenly. The sound of his shout cut cleanly through the laughter and silenced it. McVries's face was dark with suffused blood. The scar stood out in dead white contrast, like a slashed exclamation mark. And for one fear-filled moment, Garrity thought he was having a stroke.
"Major buggers himself, that's what I think," McVries cried hoarsely. "You guys, you probably bugger each other. Pretty funny, huh? Pretty funny, you bunch of motherfuckers, right? Pretty goddamn funny, am I right?"
Other walkers stared uneasily at McVries and then eased away. McVries suddenly ran at the half track. 2 of the 3 soldiers raised their guns to high port, ready, but McVries halted dead, and raised his fists at them, shaking them above his head like a mad conductor.
"Come on down here! Put down those rifles and come on down here! I'll show you what's funny!"
"Warning," one of them said in a perfectly neutral voice. "Warning, 61. Second warning."
"Oh my God," Garrity thought numbly. "He's going to get it and he's so close.
so close to them. He'll fly through the air, just like Freaky D'Alessio.
McVries broke into a run, caught up with the half track, stopped, and spat on the side of it. The spittle cut a clean streak through the dust on the side of the half track.
Come on! McVries screamed. Come on down here! One at a time or all at once! I don't give a shit!
Warning. Third warning, 61. Final warning.
Fuck your warnings!
Suddenly, unaware he was going to do it, Garrity turned and ran back, drawing his own warning. He only heard it with some back part of his mind. The soldiers were drawing down on McVries now. Garrity grabbed McVries' arm.
Come on! Get out of here, Ray! I'm gonna fight them!
Garrity put out his hands and gave McVries a hard, flat shove. You're going to get shot, you asshole! Stebbins passed them by. McVries looked at Garrity, seeming to recognize him for the first time. A second later, Garrity drew his own third warning, and he knew McVries could only be seconds away from his ticket.
Go to hell, McVries said in a dead, washed-out voice. He began to walk again.
Garrity walked with him.
I thought you were going to buy it, that's all, he said.
But I didn't, thanks to the musketeer, McVries said sullenly. His hand went to the scar.
Fuck, we're all going to buy it.
Somebody wins. It might be one of us.
It's a fake,
McVries said, his voice trembling.
There's no winner. No prize. They take the last guy out behind a barn somewhere and shoot him, too.
Don't be so fucking stupid,
Garrity yelled at him furiously.
You don't have the slightest idea what you're saying.
Everyone loses, McVries said.
His eyes peered out of the dark cave of his sockets like baleful animals. They were walking by themselves. The other walkers were keeping away, at least for the time being. McVries had shown red, and so had Garrity, in a way.
He had gone against his own best interest when he ran back to McVries.
In all probability, he had kept McVries from being number 28.
Everyone loses, McVries repeated. You better believe it.
They walked over a railroad track. They walked under a cement bridge. On the other side, they passed a boarded-up Dairy Queen with a sign that read, "Will reopen for season, June 5th. Olson drew a warning. Garrity felt a tap on his shoulder and turned around. It was Stebbins. He looked no better or worse than he had the night before.
Your friend there is jerked at the major, he said.
McVries showed no sign of hearing.
I guess so, yeah, Garrity said. I myself have passed the point where I'd want to invite him home for tea.
Look behind us. Garrity did. A second half-track had rolled up, and as he looked, a third fell in behind it,
coming in off a side road.
The major's coming, Stebbins said, and everybody will cheer.
He smiled, and his smile was oddly lizard-like.
They don't really hate him yet. Not yet. They just think they do. They think they've been through hell. But wait until tonight. Wait until tomorrow.
Garrity looked at Stebbins uneasily. What if they hiss and boo and throw canteens at him or something?
Are you going to hiss and boo and throw your canteen?
No.
Neither will anyone else. You'll see.
Stebbins? Stebbins raised his eyebrows. You think you'll win, don't you?
Yes, Stebbins said calmly. I'm quite sure of it.
And he dropped back to his usual position. At 5:25, Yannick bought his ticket, and at 5:30 a.m., just as Stebbins had predicted, the major came. There was a winding, growling roar as his jeep bounced over the crest of the hill behind them. Then it was roaring past them, along the shoulder. The major was standing at full attention. As before, he was holding a stiff, eyes-right salute. A funny chill of pride went through Garrity's chest. Not all of them cheered. Collie Parker spat on the ground. Barkovich thumbed his nose.